So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
And tell the black that you come out here and you talk about baby Don Paul driving that boy, putting that boy out of wrestling, talking about boy this and boy that. Well, David, you know my youngest, Till Margaret, is 2.5 years old. And I tell her a story about the cold-blooded sausage maker that's walking through the woods and these little pigs run around. And he grabs the little pigs, and he making cold-blooded sausage out of them. But always in that story, when she's scared and her eyes are big as silver dollars, the American dream comes and saves the little piggies. But in this case, I am the cold-blooded sausage maker. Tully Blanchard, and you the little piggies, and you running around with one big pig. That's right. Now I hope my mama don't call David and get on for me talking this way. But she ain't no lady. She ain't no 10. She's nothing more than something off the... I ain't even gonna talk about it. And you talking about now you got to deal with a dealer. That's fine. Because that's risky business. I am risky business. I am the cool, bloody sausage maker.
He's just a common man, working hard with his hands. He's just a common man, working hard for the man. Hey, he's a American dream.
Hello and welcome to Review Away. My name is John Pollock, alongside the man that gravity always pays tribute to, Wei Teng.
You said I'm fat?
No. I said that gravity.
That's exactly what that means.
No. It's if...
Pays, you know, tribute to.
Listen, if you... from a logical standpoint, the man that gravity forgot, would that not mean that when Neville jumps off the top for the Red Arrow, he would just keep flying into outer space? That would mean, yeah, he would never come back down.
That's what that means. If you were to take everything that was ever said literally, yes, that would be what that meant.
Well, I mean, that tagline, I mean, it's...
Okay, so we should abandon all nicknames.
All nicknames, I mean...
All nicknames have to be...
Ones that should not be questioned.
All nicknames have to be scientifically factual. Is that what you're saying?
Well, let me ask you this. Was it factual that the career of Virgil Runnels could be encapsulated by being called the American Dream? That's a fitting nickname.
Is it, though? Or would it be more fitting if he was an actual dream formation? Like that somebody went to sleep, a little child went to sleep and dreamt this character up.
Listen, if I was to tell
you... In America.
If I was to tell you this way... At the last set of tryouts in Orlando for the WWE, a 300-pound man came to the tryouts, and he cut a spiritual promo that was closer to like a preacher than any scripted promo, and he's got this big splotch on his belly, and he's not the greatest of workers, but in 5 years... He's going to be one of the biggest draws in the U.S. You tell me, Pollock, I watch WWE every week. You're dreaming if that guy would become a star. So in many ways, he was the American Dream.
Okay. Sure.
Are you ready to chat about the career of Dusty Rhodes? I'm excited for this show.
Yeah, let's
do it. Going to be a lot of fun. For those of you that only tune in week by week to Review Away, we are not reviewing the Daniel Bryan... Yes, DVD. Dusty Rhodes, of course, passed away last Thursday, and Wei and I decided, no, we should do a review of Dusty Rhodes' career, because I think it's kind of on everyone's mind at this point, a lot of reminiscing, a lot of going back and watching so many different elements of Dusty Rhodes' career, whether it be matches, promos, booking, so many different ways that you can analyze the career, the legacy of Dusty Rhodes. And I know you, like myself, just went down the rabbit hole of the Dusty Rhodes career online through DVDs. I've watched a ton of Dusty over the past week.
I feel like I have too. And that's more than I could say for my entire, life. Because I largely missed his entire run. You know, from the time that I started becoming a fan, really, like in the early 90s, he was already kind of well past even his WWE run. So I was not exposed to any of, you know, him, particularly in his prime in the 80s and even the 70s stuff.
Yeah, I think both of us kind of fit into that same boat. Like, I started watching pro wrestling early 92. So, I mean, this was at the point where he had finished the polka dot run, but I mean, I feel I've gone back and I've just over my lifespan watched so much of Dusty that I feel like I have watched various chapters of his career. And it's very misleading because to a certain subset of fans of one generation of kind of our age, a lot of them associate Dusty as a commentator in WCW and being involved in the NWO. And during that entire stretch of the Monday Night Wars, do you know how many matches he worked on Nitro?
How many?
Zero. Do you know how many matches he worked total in WCW from 95 until they went out of business?
How many?
Two matches he worked. But he was such a constant on that program. And then he had the minor run, I'll call it, in ECW that I think a lot of people remembered, in particular the feud with Steve Corino. But again, it was a handful of matches, by his standards, quite a lot that he worked. He worked more for ECW than WCW during those last number of years, and then returned to WCW right at the end. And his final WCW match was a Kiss My Ass tag match,
which is actually included on that DVD. And, you know, much of what I watched, of course, came from that 2006 WWE DVD release on Dusty Rhodes, which I think we'll probably refer to a lot on this show. This might as well be a review about that DVD.
This was so strange because Wei and I decided, well, let's go back. We'll pick out some matches from Dusty Rhodes' career, and that can certainly jumpstart the conversation. And then Wei mentioned, I watched the documentary on Dusty, and I came back and said, I watched it too. Yeah. You and I did not plan to do this, but we both watched the documentary. And that DVD set, I must say, you know, sometimes the WWE will miss the mark and you're always left wanting more. That's a pretty thorough three-disc set by WWE standards, from the promos, matches, going all the way back to Florida for Dusty.
Even the documentary, I'll say, you know, like we talked about that Jerry Lawler documentary just 2 weeks ago, and we talked about kind of how we felt a lot of his Memphis career was kind of lacking in detail, but I don't think this was it at all. And especially for somebody, you know, like myself, who was not aware of really this guy. You know, you always hear about what a legend this guy is, but I don't know the detail about, you know, this guy's matches, how he won his championships, how many championships he's had, you know, the context of the time. I thought the documentary, which is available on the network, which is how I watched it, the Dusty Rhodes doc, and the DVD itself, I thought really does a great job encapsulating this man's entire career into one set.
Yes, and throughout the show, we'll air some Dusty Rhodes promos. We're also going to have an interview that I found from 2005 that Dan Lavransky conducted with Dusty Rhodes right when his book came out. So we're going to have that up on the show as well. And we're going to discuss some of the matches from his career that were on that DVD that myself and Wei went back and watched. And I think just to put into context, I mean, Dusty Rhodes and his kind of entry into professional wrestling, he came into the industry and started his career working as a heel and teaming with Dick Murdoch as the Texas Outlaws, and went all over the place. And it was in Florida that Dusty truly made his mark. And one of the matches we'll talk about was in 1974, where he made that babyface turn, where he was part of Gary Hart's stable. And it was something so simple as the babyface ducking and Pac Song nailing Dusty Rhodes. And it just, that was the climax of Dusty Rhodes turn and became the biggest drawing card in Florida for the next decade before he'd go off to Mid-Atlantic. But in Florida, I mean, that was where – that was home base for him, working under Eddie Graham, and where he would become a major attraction all over the country. Mm-hmm. And that included the WWWF at the time.
Yeah, so I think what we're going to do on this show is we've selected a number of matches – throughout his career, mostly from like a notable, you know, highlights that he's experienced, and we'll just kind of tell the story, I think, through these matches and the time periods.
Yeah, and we can start off with the tag match that we selected of Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch against the Crusher and Dick the Bruiser, who were one of their main tag teams that they were feuding with in the AWA. And this match took place March the 9th of 1973 at the Chicago Amphitheater. On my birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You
know, it's...
we're minus 11.
I felt so old watching this because I'm like, man, 1973, that sounds so long ago. And it was only 11 years before I was born. I mean, not a crazy period of time between the two.
Not really.
I mean, right. I'm a sixth grader in between this match and my birth. I turn everything on to me. How does this historical match affect me?
We measure every match now. What is it? BJP. BJP before John Pollock.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. BC.
This was 11, AD. 11 BJP.
Exactly. It aired in highlight form. These matches, a lot of them were edited down and.
Yeah, this was all, of course, on that DVD collection, and a lot of these earlier matches, it's amazing that we even have this footage, you know? I think a lot of these seemed like they were from a collection that I assume somebody put together at some point, featuring Gordon Solie and Dusty Rhodes commentating over some of these highlights.
Yeah, for the DVD, they did bring in Mike Graham to join Dusty Rhodes to give context at the time to the Florida tapes, which Mike Graham had owned those tapes and then sold them over. And then they also had Steve Romero, who was a fly-by-night announcer. He was like a sports broadcaster.
I don't
broadcaster.
Remember this dude at all.
No one remembers him.
Was he in the WWE?
Yeah. He was there for, God, I want to say maybe 18 months, 2 years, something like that. His real name is Todd Romero. He, to me, was a guy that I'm completely generalizing. Guy with a sports background, came to the WWE, had probably never watched wrestling, and was thrust here with commentating the history of Dusty Rhodes. And
the wrong guy to do this.
Absolutely. Why Jim Ross was not a part of this, I cannot give you a good answer. This was in 2006. I mean, Jim Ross was still on television at the time. He would have been a much better utilized voice for these matches.
But you wonder who on the roster would have been appropriate for something like that. I suppose, you know, Joey Styles, was he a part of the team at that time?
In 2006, he was.
I think he would have been much better, probably. But, like, you know that they hire commentators not based on their knowledge of pro wrestling. They hire them based on probably their look and, you know.
But I would argue you're selling this DVD
Absolutely.
To people
oh,
who
yeah.
do want that.
Absolutely.
And that is the audience you're catering to.
I would have preferred if Simon Dean did the commentary. He seemed to be a real fan.
I would have been fine with the Great Khali doing commentary. So
this match, actually, this one wasn't one of those.
No, this was actually like older commentary involving Gordon Solie and
actually,
Dusty Rhodes.
This actually wasn't even this.
Sorry, match. You're right. I'm getting ahead of myself to the Florida stuff. Yeah, this was.
Was just some third party, you know, uncredited announcer that they found footage of.
Yeah, and I mean, not a whole lot to this other than Rhodes and Murdoch ended up both bleeding. When their heads were run into each other, and we got a 1973 unprotected chair shot delivered to Dusty Rhodes, and the referee called off the match as they applied the stomach claws to Murdoch and Rhodes.
It would suck to, you know, be a wrestler back then and be that far away from knowledge of the damage of unprotected chair shots. You know, like, let's say if I was a wrestler in, like, 2006 and I took some chair shots to the head. Well, at least I was maybe only a couple years away from, you know, knowing the some actual research about what these things were doing to me. But if I was, like, in 1973 taking these chair shots, it would be, like, 30 years, 30, 40 years.
Wow. I mean, when all this stuff is coming out in the last 10 years, if you're a wrestler from this era and you were taking chair shots, I'm done. But I mean, my argument always to that, you know, people will bring up, it's like, oh, we didn't know. You know, when I was 7 years old, my parents got me my first bike. Okay. And they were going to take the training wheels off. And I was told, you have to always wear a helmet no matter what. Mm. We trust you with this bike that you will wear a helmet. You know why, Wei? Because I knew at that age that if I fall on my head, it's bad. I know that hitting my head means that my brain is at risk. And I knew that at 7 years old. So the idea that, you know what? I can hit myself on the head. You can do it a right way. No, there's not a right way to deliver trauma to your head. And I think that underlines everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can all come up with our witch doctor analysis of, you know, the right way to take a chair shot to the head. It sounds insane to me. And I'm sure if you were to call up Chris Nowinski, he would laugh at your theory of a properly hit chair shot to the head. Mm. But here we go, 1973. Sometimes issues of the present go back decades and decades. But a quick match and one of many, many matches they had. They had two of these matches on the DVD. I only watched this March 9th one, but they came back with it a few weeks later. And this was a notable tag program in the AWA in the early 70s.
Yeah, the crowd, you know, it was hard to tell because I think a lot of the noise was at least a very low mix, or maybe it might have even been added after the fact. But the look of the crowd seemed like they were very, very lively. It's just cool footage. You can't really gauge much about the match itself because it was in highlight form. But it's just really cool to see the footage and to see this team, you know, in existence. I mean, the documentary kind of goes more in depth about Dick Murdoch and Dusty Rhodes as a team themselves. And you have clips from people like Triple H even describing them, you know, as a revolutionary team because they're one of the first heel teams that showed you can be heels while still being entertaining.
Yes, and eventually they would break up the team with Rhodes going in the singles direction, and it was in Florida that we go to our next match, which is a very famous match at the time, and one that I was trying to find online and then looked up, and the fact that this was on the Dusty Rhodes DVD, mm-hmm. I was stunned, and then had to find this DVD, which Wei...
Oh, yes, this was a thing in itself.
I will tell you. I went down to my storage area, and I had it like 95% sure in my head I have this DVD. But there was that 5% that, do I have it? And I went through the everything in there, and I could not find it anywhere. So I was like, it has to be upstairs somewhere. I go back, and I have very few wrestling things in my main area. And I went through all that shit. It was nowhere. And I'm like, Christ. So then I went back down to my storage area, and when I say I took everything out of this thing, I took every last box out of here. The second to last box. At the very bottom, the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. I spent like over an hour looking for this bloody DVD. I was glad I found it, but my God, I need a better system than this.
Well, you've been digitizing everything, but I guess that wouldn't include DVDs. These DVDs, I feel like I would actually keep these, you know, like a lot of these, especially after the WWF bought WCW and ECW. They started making these amazing compilations, and I think about, you know, the Flair doc and the Bret doc. Those are other, like, great all-encompassing video collections.
These things just need to entirely be on the network. Everything needs to be on the network.
I'm sure like a good deal of the documentaries are, but and I'm sure a lot of the matches are too, but you just have to individually find all of them.
What did you think of how, you know, we're in this new age of the WWE with this 24-hour a day, 7 day a week network. Mm-hmm. To me, it's Dusty passes away. Everything programming should have been broken into, and this DVD should have been shown. There should have been, you know, go to the NXT show that night, the WWE live events, get live reaction from performers. It's like, treat this like a news story.
Like breaking news, such and such.
Like, that's what I want out of the network. I don't want massive news where I'm going everywhere but the WWE network because the 80th airing of Total Divas this week is currently in progress.
I think that would be interesting. It would be interesting. That would, you know, require them to basically kind of switch to like more of a CNN format rather than what they are right now.
Well, even to put the Dusty Rhodes, like, absolutely. You and I both instinctually, we went to the network to find the documentary and to watch it.
And I was surprised that that wasn't publicized maybe a bit more, maybe because they were working on their own thing that you know, we watched on Monday night, which we talked about on Monday, but we won't talk about now. And maybe it was that reason, but you're right. I think that maybe that documentary, like this documentary, I thought was great and really should have been publicized. I think a lot of people don't even know that it's up there on the network.
Like when a major figure passes away, most people that are familiar with said personality, they just can't get enough. They just, like I know when someone dies, all I want to do is read and go back and learn as much as I can about this particular figure, mainly because I feel I'm going to be talking about it. But I mean, there's just that – it's a major issue. And you want to go and seek out matches or promos or read about his career and find out the story of this person's life. And
They do that. Like, I mean, you know, like when Warrior passed, they dedicated, you know, a large chunk of their programming to him.
I just think that's the next step of the WWE Network from just this
– to have breaking news and have like –
well,
Renee
just to be on top of things a bit more rather than we have this rigid schedule that we never break into, we never change the format, and we don't react to what is happening in the moment.
Keep in mind, I mean, they're still a growing company with, I believe, a limited staff. You know, they're not as big as a CNN nor
– Way. They're bigger than Major League Baseball, Sony – Nickelodeon, ESPN, The Lord, everything.
They're bigger than a lot of things, yes. I don't disagree with that. I think in the future, it should really be something like that. They should maybe even have live VJs. Remember that? VJs.
Wow, yeah. They should totally get...
Rick the Temp. Or Damian Abraham.
Damian Abraham on the network.
Yeah. And, you know, the VJ can throw to certain things and comment on live everyday daily news like that. Do a daily news. John Pollock, daily news update.
No.
Yeah.
I would defer to somebody. You know what? That guy we met for the first time at WrestleMania weekend, Kyle. That guy Kyle?
I think Kyle would be...
He'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah, I just met him then, but I think he'd be tremendous at that job. But you're right. I think in the future, absolutely. I think right now, though, they're just so systemized right now that the whole network just basically existing off of a wheel tape library.
I'm just saying you have a very captive audience that they're craving anything at that point,
totally.
And you have this outlet now to utilize that and react to major events that are happening, and I think that that's just the next step. And
well, it only has been a week. I expect them to maybe do.
I don't doubt it. It's just Thursday. Everyone's going around to see as much as they can about Dusty and your network.
Just look at the online. If you Google Dusty Rhodes, at the number of lists of all the top promos compiled by all these bloggers.
Did it surprise you in any sense the fact that this was one of those wrestler deaths that did transcend wrestling? This was very much on par with a Macho Man Randy Savage.
Warrior.
This was Ultimate Warrior. Yeah. Those larger than life figures that, I mean, it's incredible how many people were aware of Dusty Rhodes, that connected with people and felt like a cultural figure passed away last week.
It didn't surprise me because I mean, even from what little I've actually seen of his actual, the highlights of his career, I knew this guy was a big deal. He's a legend. He's a Hall of Famer. He's a main eventer. And I categorize him with those top guys. And I wasn't surprised at all by that reaction.
So we go to May of 1974 at the infamous Fort Homer Hesterly Armory, which became the home base of Championship Wrestling from Florida, and you can certainly credit Dusty Rhodes as the biggest attraction at that armory. Every Tuesday night, the promotion would run in that building, and this particular match with Dusty Rhodes and Pac Song, managed by Gary Hart, taking on Eddie and Mike Graham, with Gordon Solie and Dusty on commentary, which had to have been done closer to the time of this, I'm sure. Looking back in retrospect at this particular match, but certainly done decades and decades ago, I would assume.
And again, this match was presented in highlight form, but I can excuse that because this was Dusty Rhodes commentating in character, essentially cutting a promo,
dude,
you know, throughout the whole thing. And that made this so entertaining.
Listen, Dusty Rhodes, a lot of people talk about this was a man that had some huge ideas, and he had a huge ego. He had a giant love of his own self. Mm-hmm. And hearing him commentate his own matches was awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy was like in awe of himself.
Yeah.
And we'll get to that later. The best finish for the Great American Bash title change. But here we have the big turn that would occur that would set off the Florida territory. Some of the highlights of this match, Eddie Graham was bleeding during the match. The amount of blood. I mean, every match I think I went back and saw Dusty in, guy bladed.
Mm.
I mean, every match. Dusty,
well, you look at the scarring on his forehead.
He did. I'm surprised it wasn't worse. Yeah. After this guy going through Florida, through Jim Crockett Promotions during that 80s period where they were just cutting each other up on every show, it's amazing this guy had any tissue left on his forehead. Dusty hit the bionic elbow. He's describing this violence, and he takes Mike Graham, shoves him, and knocks the referee down as well. And then Dusty holds up Mike Graham for Pac Song to deliver a chop, but then Mike ducks. I mean, the tried and true double team gone wrong spot. Mike ducks, and Pac Song chops Dusty, and Dusty is outraged on commentary. Even going back, I mean, just cannot fathom that Mike Graham escaped this chop, and Pac Song having the reflexes of an elephant not to hold up and chopping Dusty. And this was it. This was the straw that broke Dusty's back. And Song then applied the claw to Eddie Graham, and Gary Hart comes in attacking Mike, and Dusty returns to, quote, whip that honky Korean's head and attacks Pac Song, and this crowd of 6,000 people erupted. And Gary starts attacking Dusty with kicks from the apron. He attacks Hart in the ring, which, I mean, Gary Hart was the kind of manager, you lay your hands on him, and that was the big heat, was just getting your hands on the Weasley manager. And then Dusty Rhodes, like, cut a homily. I can't even call this a promo. Describing his turn that,
yeah,
I'm not doing it for me anymore. I'm doing it for 6,000 people.
And now I got to do something for myself, for my pride, for my daddy, for everybody that was associated with. Now I got to get off that floor, baby. Go in that ring and beat up four men. You understand what I'm saying? I done beat up Graham. Now I got to go in right here. I'm going for one reason, baby. And that's to whip that honky Korean's head, because I am the dream. I am the man. Go on with it, baby. Right there. Come and get it, baby. And right now, too, I'm taking the heart of the people in this city, people of all over. This ain't local, baby. This is real. Right here is reality. Honky Gary Hart with his flat feet, semi-professional wino from Chicago. Right here, backing off of me. Now I'm doing my thing. The roar is louder. My heart is pounding. And now I'm not only doing it for me, baby. I'm doing it for 6,000 people in the Fort Heffley Armory. And right here, I've got another sneak attack. Pearl Harbor. And now I want to show you something that's very dear to me. This piece of tape. This piece of tape, baby, is worth a lifetime of things. Because this shows a man, not a boy. Not a boy trying to be something he ain't, but a man raised by a man, brother. And Mike Graham becomes a brother right here. A brother to me, a brother to Tampa, a brother to the people of the United States of America. Brother, this ain't honky. I ain't flag waving. I'm talking about professional athletes. Heart, one is one. Right here is truth.
And when Pac Song attacked him from behind, described it as a Pearl Harbor job, as mm-hmm. Pac Song changed his citizenship on the fly from Korea to Japan.
How did that term actually originate?
Pearl Harbor?
Well, I mean, in pro wrestling terms. Like, who started using it in a pro wrestling context to talk about?
Oh, I can't remember, but it was just, you know, the sneak attack. The go-to line was those Japanese mm-hmm. attacking us from behind, those heels. I don't know who coined it first. For our purposes, it can be Dusty.
Sure.
So Pac Song attacks him. Mike Graham then comes to the assistance of Dusty, which, I mean, this is a big deal. Dusty and Gary Hart's crew, they had been feuding with the Grahams, and here that Mike Graham was coming to Dusty's rescue, and Dusty says that Mike Graham became his brother that day as they shake hands. And unfortunately, you couldn't hear the promo that he cut to the crowd in the building that night, like a independent show level microphone.
I don't really know how much television was being recorded across the country at pro wrestling events, but I mean, at least in this territory, it seemed like the beginnings of it. Just really one camera trying to capture the whole event. It was just, again, it's hard to kind of gauge the match quality itself, but I just see this as like historical significant footage that I think we should just be grateful that exists even.
Yeah, this was the start of Dusty Rhodes and this incredible 10-year babyface run for the Florida promotion. I mean, he would become a 10-time Florida heavyweight champion over the next 6 years and just created a connection with the audience that I think few can ever lay claim to the degree of Dusty Rhodes in Florida. And, I mean, those that lived through it can better articulate what Dusty Rhodes meant in Florida, and that transferred outside to other territories, and he became very much in demand.
On the documentary itself, you have, current performers of that time in 2005 on the roster, like Simon Dean talking about growing up and his memories of seeing Dusty Rhodes in that territory. And, he just seemed like someone who was immediately relatable to your typical viewer, not a guy who looks like your Superman's, but a guy who, was a little looked out of shape, but he worked hard. And, that's the first thing I really noticed is the physiques of this time. But, he looks out of place, but he wasn't chiseled, but he looked thick and strong, like a dad. You know what I mean?
The dad bod.
The dad bod, exactly, which is apparently a big thing online. Did you read those articles?
I haven't read the articles.
The dad bod, yeah. I think it started off with a poll where a bunch
of... Did it start with the DiCaprio pick? Is that, that's where
no,
I think...
No, Seth Rogen.
Seth Rogen? Because they showed Leonardo DiCaprio on a beach with kind of the belly, and they were the introduction of the dad bod.
Okay, I don't know about that, but I think
Please, please settle this dispute.
I don't know it myself either, but I mean...
You don't have a dad bod.
No, I don't.
I don't feel weird talking about your physique way, but you're in good shape, man.
No, I wouldn't say I have.
You're chiseled.
I wouldn't say I have.
You are, man.
Either. No, I would not say that. I would have the opposite of the Dusty Rhodes.
You have a very
skinny.
For those out there that want to draw a comparison, I mean, Yohei Kamatsu of New Japan Pro Wrestling, one of the Young Lions. I mean, that is way, essentially.
I don't know who that is. But
you
anyway,
need more of a. You need to cut your hair a little.
But the dad bod is, it's like a thing that online. I think that started from a bunch of women, or somebody, some website or some magazine did a poll asking women what their ideal body type was, and a lot of women said they would rather marry somebody who looked like Seth Rogen than somebody who looked like Scott Putski.
Great comparison. Yeah. Gives hope for everybody, I guess. Have you heard?
But anyway, that's Dusty Rhodes. Dusty Rhodes.
Listen,
I have
every
a point
single
to all this.
Article I have read about Dusty Rhodes over the last week, everyone has pointed out his physique.
Yeah.
I mean, that was it's almost amazing. It's like this great shock. How could this man get over with a body like that? And I was like, man, this guy got over at a time where the idea of what a pro wrestler was, much wider scope than it is. I think for today's audience, it's stunning. It's stunning that a Kevin Owens is in the position he is. But, I mean, look at some of the bodies of the 80s. Go back
Dude,
to the 70s
look at
in
this,
the AWA.
Look at this first match, Dick Murdoch and Dusty Rhodes versus Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher. No Scott Putski candidates in that match,
and
you say.
And look at how big those stars were. I mean, Dick the Bruiser, the Crusher in Milwaukee. I mean, these were cultural figures in the case of Dick the Bruiser, the Crusher, and Dusty. And Dick Murdoch is arguably one of the most respected performers of anyone who ever worked with this guy.
And I guarantee you, at the time, none of their credibility as athletes was really questioned. You know, these guys looked tough and they played the part and they were convincing.
But would they get on tough enough?
They have like one or two like more hefty looking dudes.
Well, they've cut it down to 13 right now. I think they've cut the fat.
Yeah, it's tough enough. I don't know. I don't know if they'd make it.
The fact that we can discuss, we mentioned this with Dave Meltzer on Sunday, you know, asking the question, would Dusty Rhodes going to a tryout today, would he get into developmental in the WWE? The fact that that is a question depresses me about this industry. The fact
sure.
that a Dusty Rhodes...
I think that's starting to change, though. You see that with you know... But again, Kevin Owens and Samoa Joe, these are kind of more outliers because they made their name outside of that whole system mm-hmm. first.
I just think you'd also... I mean, Dusty Rhodes would not be cutting the same promos that were his calling card in throughout his entire career, mm-hmm. But had a level of charisma that... The key people do. I mean, Kevin Owens, he is somebody that can cut a promo. And
he needed to go outside of the system to be able to prove that. I mean, for really over 10 years before he even got a chance.
Our next match involves Dusty Rhodes and Terry Funk, with Terry Funk defending the NWA Championship. This was in Florida and featured the Missouri Mauler, Larry Hamilton, trying to attack Dusty before the match and gets fought off as Funk gets the early advantage. And Terry Funk, you want to couple someone with Dusty who, I mean, these two feuded for decades. I mean, right up until the 2000s where they were still drawing in Florida based off of their feud of the 70s and onwards.
Dusty Rhodes, you no good for nothing, egg-sucking dog. I'm sick and tired of having you claim to be a cowboy. You with your putrid body, your varicose veins, trying to claim that you are the greatest at a bull rope match. You don't even know what a bull rope match is. You don't even know what a rodeo is. You're a drug store cowboy. That's exactly what you are. And I've rode in rodeo after rodeo after rodeo. And I intend on doing the same if I ever get you in the ring in a bull rope match.
Two guys that you can draw a lot of comparisons who went through many transformations throughout their career, have been involved in the industry right up until the present. And you go back to the 70s, and I mean, Terry Funk, drastically different from how he would appear in the 80s. Drastically different from how he would appear in the 90s. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was somebody that was a completely different performer if you're only familiar with Terry Funk post-1995, for instance.
Totally. Absolutely. And I think he's another name, much like Dusty Rhodes, that, I mean, I've only seen a chunk of his career of, and I would just kill to have a DVD collection or a documentary made much like this one, encompassing his entire career. So hopefully someday we get that.
Yeah, I don't mean to be too depressing, but you really think about when someone like a Dusty Rhodes passes away and those links to the early 70s and to an era where, you know, it's sad that a lot of these performers are going to pass on and you don't replace that kind of knowledge base of these guys who, and Terry Funk is another one of those guys that go back to that period that can also transfer it to other generations that they worked in and translate what worked in the 70s to a performer in 2015 that has to perform under the guidelines of today's system and how you work all of that together. And I think Terry Funk very much an equal to Dusty Rhodes in that regard. Rhodes caught Funk with a back elbow, hit a running elbow drop and pinned Terry Funk. But then a second referee ran in saying that Funk had been thrown over the top rope and therefore the title change is teased, but then it's pulled away from the crowd. And Dusty attacks Funk after the match, and then Mahler returns and attacks Dusty. But maybe the seed planted way.
he was in this match and said, wow, this worked really well.
We teased something, and then we took it away from them. We gave them the high, and then we brought them back down to earth. this could really work. And in moderation, it would. And it, contrary to popular belief and this kind of evidence of it, I mean, Dusty was not the one who invented this finish, but he was certainly the one that popularized it.
Right.
Then we that kind of wraps up kind of the Florida portion, and then we go to matches of Dusty outside of his home base. And at this time in 1978, superstar Billy Graham, he had dropped the WWWF championship to Bob Backlund, and now he was kind of in this post run after the championship. And Dusty Rhodes was, he was very big in the New York market because the Florida tapes were airing on a Spanish language channel in New York. So, and between that and magazine coverage at the time, it allowed Dusty Rhodes, who certainly with that face, that look in particular, bloodied, very much lent himself to magazine covers during the day.
Yeah.
He was instantly transferable to the New York crowd.
That was a big question I had was, I mean, first of all, I have to say, you know, this the whole story of Dusty Rhodes' career was really nice to look back on because as somebody who never lived through the territorial system, this is really the backdrop for this man's career. And to see him be able to travel from Florida to New York, you really kind of get a sense of how distinct all the little promotions were and how special it was when a guy like Dusty Rhodes would go up to New York to face, you know, somebody from there. It was almost like a DC character coming over to like take on, you know, Spider-Man and Marvel.
Yeah.
You know what I mean,
it was in that day where you would read about all of these particular performers and then they were coming to your home territory. That was a lot of the draw of the NWA champion coming to town, and he was going to be taking on your guy, your the promotion's top guy who would try to win the title. So in this case, Dusty Rhodes, this was before his first NWA title run, after Graham's run with the title in New York. And I will say I believe that the series of matches with Dusty were the best matches of superstar Billy Graham's career. I mean, a guy who was very much a great character, a great promo, but certainly was his in-ring was not his calling card. This was a Texas Bull Rope match, August the 28th of 1978 at Madison Square Garden.
The third of the trilogy.
Yes, there, and this would be the wrap-up of their Madison Square Garden series, and then they would take this all over the territory in the Northeast. It's joined in progress. Chief J. Strongbow, the referee for this Texas Bull Rope match in Texas. Not in Texas, no. Graham is choking him with the rope.
Was this the first match of its kind, or was this match had this been done?
No. Right. Bull rope matches had been done, and you know, one of those few. I mean, very different versions of it. I mean, with different kind of stipulations.
Dusty on commentary kind of takes credit for creating the stipulation.
I don't believe he was the one to start them because I'm pretty sure that Terry Funk Sr. was doing them in Amarillo. That would have predated Dusty. Who was on commentary for this particular
match?
Well,
there was alternate commentary. You could either, on the DVD at least, you could hear the Vince McMahon version of Vince originally calling this match back then from the Garden.
Okay, that's what I watched.
Or you could have Dusty calling it in hindsight with that Steve dude. And
that Steve dude.
And Mike Graham.
And Mike Graham. Was there an option to mute Romero?
No, I don't think
Except Dusty and Mike Graham?
I don't think so. He
was put in an awkward position.
Hard on him, but yeah. I mean, there was such an obvious choice in Jim Ross who it shouldn't have even taken 5 seconds of debate
right.
of who should have been doing this. Graham is choking him with the rope while Dusty is bleeding, as we basically broke two rules of the current WWE system right away. And they probably would have had an edict today where you can't call it a bull rope.
He
it has
like,
to be called a mechanism of victory.
He wasn't even just choking. He was really hanging the guy like off of the side of the ring.
Yeah. Graham climbs to the top and he gets yanked off as Rhodes makes his comeback and the crowd just super excited. And, you know, Rhodes' ability to read a crowd for the big comeback and maximize it, I mean, it's an element of his work as a babyface that I don't think gets emphasized enough. Like his timing and just reading a crowd was phenomenal.
Not just even in the ring, but I think his what stands out about his promos, you know, which we can really do a whole review show on themselves. I think not just, you know, not just the lisp, which he somehow made work for him. Not just, you know, the his accent or just what he said, but it's the pacing and even the parts of silence that he injects into all of his promos that I think he just seemed like somebody who had that natural timing.
Did you happen to watch the Empty Arena promo on the DVD set?
Yeah.
I mean, so many people will look at the Hard Times promo as the definitive Dusty Rhodes promo. That Empty Arena one.
With Vince.
Yeah, with Vince.
Yeah.
That's tops for me.
Yeah.
Like, that is one of the best promos. And I'm sure I had seen it beforehand. But my God, this is literally like an 8-minute soliloquy.
Yeah.
By Dusty Rhodes. Perfect word for a Dusty promo. A soliloquy. And at the end, Vince McMahon is just, Dusty Rhodes. That's it.
Yep.
That's all he said.
That was great.
Oh, my God. It was just, it's phenomenal.
I would say, like, I wish they did more of that stuff, but I don't know how many guys you have on the current rosters that could pull something like that off.
Oh, very few. Very few, I feel. Rhodes missed an elbow in the corner, and then Graham hits some knees to the body as Strongbow goes to stop him. And Vince is just calling out, why is the referee getting involved here? They should be allowed to go at it here. It's a Texas bull rope match, goddammit. And it leads to Dusty decking him with the cowbell after he had already dug the cowbell into the forehead of superstar Billy Graham. He's sent to the floor for the count of 8. An 8 count. And the win goes to Dusty Rhodes at 6 minutes and 28 seconds as Finkel announces him the winner. And then they would take the bull rope matches to other Northeast cities. And this wrapped up their MSG run after... you know, several, you know, very strong sellouts at Madison Square Garden. This was certainly a feud that was one of Graham's highlights.
So now how did, you know, just from a booking standpoint, how did this benefit Vince Sr.'s territory to have an outsider come in and beat your guy?
Well, I mean, Dusty Rhodes was not full time with the promotion, but they had a number of dates for him. So the idea was, you know, the babyface comes in and now we can take this match all around the circuit. And I mean, these dudes did very good business together. And it was also, you know, superstar Billy Graham, they were kind of winding down. Like, they had just got the big title run out of him, where he had run with the title for so long at this point. Now coming out of it, it was kind of, you know, now it was his turn to lose to a bunch of guys. And Dusty was a super attraction at this point in time. So Dusty was, you know, given a lot during his run here.
Unfortunately, this match was again joined in progress, so we didn't really get to see the whole thing. Apparently, the whole thing was much longer, and I think you got much more of a feel of, you know, how violent they claimed this match actually was. The bull rope stipulation, I mean, today it looks so dated, you know. Anytime, it's not even something that... When was the last time we saw a bull rope match? You remember?
A Texas bull rope match? I don't think it's been called that in a long time. I mean, Dusty had one with Randy Orton, which turned out to be his last match ever in 2007 at the Great American Bash.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, today it sounds like such a dated concept, but I think to see it in this context, it seemed really perfect and fresh, you know? Like, just you're tied to your opponent. You can yank on the rope to knock your opponent down. You can use the bell as a weapon. You can use the rope itself as a weapon. It seemed like, you know, like a really good stipulation.
Well, I mean, and one of the keys was, and this is something you don't, as you know, have that kind of pressure, is that in this era with the territories, a lot of them, they lived off the house and what they drew. So when you were going to do a stipulation match, I mean, it was designed to sell tickets. And therefore, there were not going to be any King of the Ring tournaments where the loser or the winner became the loser and just would lose all coming out of it. And it's a stipulation that meant nothing. I mean, they educated their crowds, whether it was Texas death matches or bull rope matches or cage matches at the end of Bruno's big program for the title, or it was the Battle Royals in San Francisco. I mean, you were told these stipulation matches, these are important, and therefore they were treated as such, and crowds reacted, wow, they're going to have a Texas bull rope match. I know from past matches that I'm going to see blood. I'm going to see a winner. I'm going to see a loser. Yeah. This is high stakes.
Totally.
And, you know, we have to keep these stipulations strong. Whereas today, what the WWE does on Monday night, it's not going to affect their business coming back the next week. It's much different, where stipulations, a lot of them have been prostituted because...
Well, you think about the Hell in a Cell and what initially the visuals and the violence that you associate with the stipulation, but now it's just a cage.
It is, and you know, the Royal Rumble would be no different if the winner of the match didn't headline WrestleMania, or it was a joke winner. I mean, a stipulation is only as strong as you protect it. Mm. Then we move on to kind of the period where Dusty Rhodes, his home base was still Florida, but now he was kind of thrust into the NWA title picture, and he would have the title three different times in his career. And what's amazing is that for a guy that was such a massive star in the 70s and 80s, his total run with those three titles was like something like 105 days. I mean, they were not lengthy title reigns at all. He largely drew and worked without being the NWA champion. And his first title win, it came in August of 1979, where he defeated Harley Race in Tampa and then would drop it 5 days later. And then he won his second title in 1981 from Harley. And that's the match that we will talk about now, which took place at the Omni in Atlanta with Gordon Solie on commentary. Race defending the title, and again, this was an edited down match, but I really just enjoy that a WWE DVD covered so much of
this. Absolutely.
Yeah, with different territories.
Now, this took place in Atlanta, which was the home territory of...
Well, this would have been like Georgia Championship Wrestling, so at this point, I mean, that was... You know, they were, with the rise of the Superstation, that allowed Georgia Championship Wrestling to be broadcast across the country. So that's where a lot of performers wanted to get on because of the exposure level.
Okay, so really just this match took place in Atlanta as opposed to Florida, for instance, because of
the TV coverage. Dusty was working, he was doing dates for Georgia Championship Wrestling at the time as well. And you have to think of it as well that with the dates he would be doing at Florida, and the scope of how many people would see this being on in Georgia Championship Wrestling, more people were going to see it. So there was a certain value proposition to Dusty Rhodes being sent there to Georgia. So Race hit his headbutt off of the second turnbuckle and then hit a pile driver to get a two count. Rhodes tosses him off the top, doing the flare bump off the top. And then Rhodes comes off the top with a high cross body and wins it with the high cross, and began his longest reign as champion at a whopping 88 days, and the actual total, 107 days, his total title reigns with those three runs with the NWA title. And he would only keep this title till September, where he would drop the title for Ric Flair's first title reign with the NWA championship. But kind of just an edited down match, but more there for historical purposes than the actual bell-to-bell match.
Yeah, this one, you know, clipped less so than the previous ones, and you do have Gordon Solie calling this, so that itself, I think, made this worthwhile to watch. But I think the best thing about this whole match was the post-match visual celebration of the moment Dusty wins and he brings all these fans into the ring. I think just as a perfect, you know, representation of what the guy's gimmick is. You know, he's the everyman, and he's celebrating with the fans.
And, I mean, a title change was a massive deal at the time. I mean, it was very significant, and this was not a Dusty finish. He actually did win the title, and... You know, we mentioned he was kind of just put into the role as getting it ready for Ric Flair at the time. And it was certainly an adjustment at the time, because right up until Harley Race, it was always the NWA champion had to be that guy that, you know, if things went screwy in the match, the champion could handle himself. And you certainly have to admit that Dusty and Ric Flair were a departure from that, where previously you had seen the Dory Funks and the Jack Briscoes.
What do you mean?
The guys that could protect themselves in a match if there was a double cross attempt.
So why do you think Dusty and Flair were departures from that?
Because, I mean, they were not guys that had those legitimate credentials. Were not noted as tough guys in the ring, like a Briscoe, like a Fez. That was still very much a mindset in the 80s at the time. And, you know, it was, I mean, we talk about the Survivor Series in 97. I mean, it was like there was always that paranoia of what could happen. But, I mean, Dusty was certainly a draw at the level where Eddie Graham certainly had a lot of power in the NWA and was able to push for that. And then Flair was kind of the chosen guy for the 80s. And that certainly segues into maybe the most significant feud of Dusty Rhodes' career. That is with Ric Flair, where the two have an incredible history together, right down to Ric Flair driving Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch around in the early days in the 70s, and Ric Flair wanting to be called Rambling Ricky Rhodes. He wanted that to be his gimmick name.
Really?
So for all the people who laugh at some of the names they come up with in NXT for guys, I mean, Ric Flair had no better.
Rambling Ricky Rhodes. Ricky Rhodes would be who, his brother?
He would have been, yeah, a relative of Dusty Rhodes. It was, wow. That was his idol. And thankfully, Dusty Rhodes told him, hey, baby, you gotta be your own baby, because you're no relation, no blood relative.
That's really good. I don't know if we heard that one before. Add that to the list.
Is that a new one?
Yeah, that one's pretty good.
So Rambling Ricky Rhodes and Dusty Rhodes would be the hallmark feud of Jim Crockett Promotions throughout the 80s. And they, of course, had the title change in 1981, and then Ric Flair would drop it back and set up the first Starrcade, where he won the title back from Harley Race. Dusty Rhodes was not booking Jim Crockett Promotions at the time, but did come up with the name Starrcade. And then it was in 1984 that he would move over to Jim Crockett Promotions, leaving Florida, where, you know, there was just more money to be made for Dusty at that point than there was in Florida. And he would come in, and quickly he would become the booker for Jim Crockett Promotions during their most profitable period in the 80s. From 84 to 86, and go head to head with the WWF and Mid South at the time. And they did phenomenal business from 84 to 86. And that's where Dusty, as a booker, that was his high point.
Ric Flair, you come out here and can talk about 13 other guys, 13 other men, and not a one of them has wore the gold around the waist one time, much less two times. Dusty Rhodes has. Two times World's Heavyweight Champion. And Ronald Reagan, you and Nancy better get your seats. And Delvin and Joe Ely, I want it rocking and socking. Because in Washington, D.C., the American dream becomes World's Heavyweight Champion for the third time. And the Four Horsemen can take that to the bank.
This match on the DVD is presented with, again, the team of Dusty Rhodes, Mike Graham, and that Steve Dude calling it.
Steve Dude was, Steve Dude. Man, some historical matches.
And it featured a lot of, like, you know, little jabs in here, funny things that, well, I mean.
There was one where Steve Dude asks Mike Graham, you know, the wrestlers of today, are they at the same level as the guys back in the... And Mike Graham, he didn't care what DVD he was producing this for. He just pretty much said, oh, the wrestlers of yesterday were way better, pretty much.
I mean, you know, and the context that with which we're viewing this, and I think in the context with which he was having that discussion, it's hard to kind of disagree in some sense. But there's that one point at the end here where Dusty Rhodes... He wins the title from Flair, and then he's like, now make sure you keep your attention, you know, to the 23rd row here in the background. You'll see Vince McMahon standing up and cheering. And I'm sure he was just bullshitting, but it was very funny. It was very funny.
Well, this feud, I mean, this was the next match we're going to review was from the Great American Bash of 1986, which was a big undertaking by Jim Crockett Promotions. They had booked dates around the country where they were going to take the promotion on tour, and that's what the Great American Bash was. It was this tour of summer events and did, you know, different levels of business depending on the main event, but the big draw was that Ric Flair was going to defend his title, I believe, 17 different times during this Great American Bash tour, and in the middle of it, it would be against Dusty Rhodes. They had headlined Starrcade in both 84 and 85, 85 featuring one of the more famous Dusty finishes where they had teased Dusty winning the title. And then in September of 85, which was setting up the Starrcade match, that's when they did a very big, a famous angle at the time. It was kind of a recreation of Ole and Dusty doing the same angle, but Dusty had come to help Ric Flair as the Koloffs were attacking him in the cage, and he was able to fight them off, and then it was Flair who was assisted by the horseman who locked the cage door and would break the ankle of Dusty Rhodes. And that was the official turn of Ric Flair. And that led to the Hard Times promo with Dusty vowing revenge, wouldn't get it done at Starrcade 85. But then we fast forward to the Great American Bash of 1986 at the Greensboro Coliseum with 15,000 people. And this was kind of the culmination where it was Dusty Rhodes and kind of this final put up or shut up kind of match where was he going to win the title from Ric Flair or not, as called by Dusty, Mike Graham, and Steve Dude. And this, they aired the entire match in its entirety. So this one, it started off Dusty applying a sleeper hold. He was in control, running into Flair. We got blood pretty early on in this match. They were in a cage, kind of had to include blood of some sort.
Ric Flair.
This was when Mike Graham noted that the older wrestlers were better than today's. Dusty getting his face rubbed right into the fencing.
It's interesting to see him watch and commentate on this because he was watching this and talking about how he could still feel everything that he was watching, you know, just everything that had taken place even 20 years ago.
Yeah, Flair went after the left ankle playing off of the angle from the prior year and setting up the figure four. Dusty would battle out and Flair tries to climb and is run into the top of the cage. Flair just begging off. And then there was a big comeback for Dusty with Flair bumping all over for him. And then Dusty would stomp on the right ankle of Ric Flair. And then Dusty is just on commentary here, getting so pumped up for what he's doing. At one point, he just yelled, "Whoa!" He was so excited by his own comeback.
Yeah,
I mean, this is.
I love that.
I love it too, man. Could you imagine, like, you watching some of your work, like, just look at this shot?
Me listening to a podcast
and reacting.
I would.
You
not.
And Steve Romero.
I'd be quiet
doing commentary. Yeah. Flair gets tossed off the top. Dusty applies the figure four. Flair gets out, and then Flair hits a crossbody off the top at the 20-minute mark. Dusty blocks a scoop slam, and as he's going for the inside cradle, Dusty wrote, this is very meta, Dusty on commentary brings attention to Dusty in the ring and just yells, "That's it! That's it!" right before the finish, and he pins him. I mean, Dusty had this moment ingrained in his head as Steve Dude and Mike Graham were busy in conversation about something. And the place just explodes for this title change. Mm-hmm. And the wrestlers enter the ring to celebrate, and Dusty shoots down Steve Romero when Romero says, "Was this the biggest or best moment of your career?" "No."
This is where everything that you've worked for in that dream we're talking about comes true, and for that split second suspended. And that right there is David Allen Cole, the mysterious Rhinestone Cowboy right there. People going crazy.
Was this your best moment?
No. No, but it was close.
It was close.
Yeah, it was close. The first time you win anything like that in Atlanta, Georgia, that's your best moment. This is wild, but it was close. It was very close.
No.
Immediately, no hesitation. No. No,
but it was close.
It was close.
Like just the softball, just hit it out of the park. It was amazing.
You just see the disappointment in Steve's face.
I've done way better, baby.
But I mean, you know, judging by his reaction winning the title, it's hard to tell that it wasn't, because I think Dusty, you know, between this and the previous match that we saw, his reaction upon winning was just so, it looked so great. Like there's like a delayed reaction between the pinfall where he's just like not reacting at all, and then he just breaks down, and it just looks like, I mean, you know, we know it's all this stuff is scripted, but it looks just like, you know, a UFC champion or whatever, a basketball player winning the NBA finals. Like it looks so good and so convincing.
Those are the tapes Ben Rothwell should be going back and watching. Dusty Rhodes, and not doing that crazy cackle of his. He wins the title. This was on July 26, 1986, and he would hold this title all the way until August 7th and then drop him back in St. Louis. So the Great American Bash, very notable because that was one of Dusty's big promotional concepts he came up with, other ones being War Games. We mentioned the name Starrcade. You know, I know all the promotional material is out, but it would kind of be a nice tribute if they just, you know, like, what does Battleground really mean to anyone? You know, the Great American Bash has so much of a history behind it. It's kind of a nice token to Dusty passing away.
What month was that, typically?
Great American Bash, I mean, it used to be a summer-long event that would go typically July, August, and then became a June pay-per-view. But that's a name to me that's really synonymous with with Dusty Rhodes. Sure. It'd be a nice kind of tribute to just name one of your shows that. I mean, I don't think the names are... No one puts a lot of emphasis in Battleground.
How about Great American Battleground?
Great American Battleground. Compromise. Of course. We've always got to compromise ideas. So there you go. That was the NWA title win, his last of his career. And, you know, 1986, it was a time period where they were going head-to-head with the WWF, going into the Northeast even, and the key cities were Baltimore and Philadelphia, where they did do very well. But it was largely, you know, they would run some shows that were just, you know, they kind of went out of their comfort zone in the Carolinas and that mid-Atlantic territory, and they would struggle in some cities, do well in others. And then come 1987, the losses started to mount creatively. I think Dusty was a little exhausted as a booker, and things kind of fell apart by the end of 87. And Dusty would continue booking there until the end of 1988. And at this point, you know, a change was kind of necessary, and they had gotten word from the network about kind of doing less blood, which, as you can tell, just based on these matches, they enjoyed their blood in Jim Crockett Promotions. So Dusty, in true Dusty fashion, responding to this request, went on television and had a beatdown angle where the Road Warriors beat down Dusty, took off a spike from their shoulder pads, and drove it into the eye of Dusty Rhodes, who was bleeding from the eye. And Dusty was told, I think we're going to move on from the Dusty era. Dusty would then go back to Florida for a brief time period, and then that would open the doors for his, I guess, return, you could call it, to the World Wrestling Federation, working under Vince McMahon Jr., and thus the polka dot era was ushered in, which, for those that had watched Dusty Rhodes in Florida and Jim Crockett Promotions, you can see why they were outraged at this treatment of a guy who was one of the biggest stars in the world, being brought in for what was largely a comedic character that I think people our age look back fondly at Dusty because it was a fun character. But, you know, try and transfer it to today where you had somebody, I don't even
know. Samoa Joe.
Sure. Samoa Joe might be an accurate one. It's hard to replicate Dusty, but taken into the WWE, and he's suddenly a Hawaiian singer who would come out and just place lays onto all of the fans, and he was a singer now instead of the hard ass kicker Samoa Joe that everyone had learned, had watched, the submission style. I mean, taking a character that you knew had worked and worked tremendously well and kind of soften it up and make into a bit of a joke for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of the era that a lot of people do recall. And the final match we'll talk about involved Dusty and his son Dustin Rhodes, who was 21 years old at the time, in the WWF, and they were feuding with Ted DiBiase. And you want to talk about meta, Dusty Rhodes feuding with Virgil.
Yeah.
His namesake, who was, I mean, a complete inside, or not so inside, rib on Dusty Rhodes when they named the character.
It seemed like this man's like entire run in the WWF at this time consisted of a number of these occurrences.
Oh, his entire career. I mean, when he went to WCW, I mean, he was named Vincent, and then he was named Shane.
Well, I meant even like in the early 90s with the WWE run here. Like, he was forced into the polka dots.
Oh, sorry, I was talking about Virgil.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
He's forced into the polka dots. He had a guy, he had another wrestler named after his fake name.
Well, I enjoyed
real name, I mean.
I enjoyed during this match when we got Dusty fighting with Virgil and was hoping one of the commentators would just lose it. But this match, November the 24th of 1990 in Madison Square Garden, and Dustin Rhodes, he had been brought in and, you know, instantly linked with his father. And there was, they even showed this on the DVD where he's cutting his promos doing a Dusty voice.
Yeah.
I mean, which, if you've ever heard Dustin Rhodes, I mean, a far cry from his father's delivery.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, it just felt like he was in a horrible spot. Like, there is no way you are going to hold your own in the shadow of your father where you are being positioned essentially as Dusty Rhodes Jr.
Well, when has that ever worked out? You know, you bring in a guy to basically play a smaller, younger, junior version of what that you know, this parent's this person's parent was.
Right. The most successful ones are the second or third generation performers that have been presented as just so far away from their father. Like, I don't think most link Cowboy Bob Orton and Randy Orton. I mean, they are just so distinct. And that might be an extreme example, but
look at what Dustin Rhodes had to become in order to really, you know.
Right. I mean, even Charlotte. I mean, she's been able to make certain references to Ric Flair, but I mean, being a female obviously kind of differentiates it. But I mean, there's a lot of guys that just cannot perform under those circumstances.
But as a way to like introduce somebody into the business, I think you almost need to make that association to get people interested.
Mm-hmm. So this match, it started with the Rhodes family storming the ring and sending DiBiase and Virgil to the floor. We had what a tandem on commentary at ringside. Sean Mooney, the Honky Tonk Man, and Jimmy Hart, because this aired on the MSG network in New York. Dustin went for a clothesline to send Virgil over the top, but Virgil can't make it over.
Ugh.
And then just leaps over, and the commentators just broke out laughing had to make fun of it. It's like, we can't cover for this. This is terrible.
And Jimmy Hart's like, oh, he wanted out. He jumped over. It looks so...
He just took a backflip.
It looks so bad.
God. Also, Dustin at 21, like, this guy, if you just watched him on his own, this guy... I would have been so high on this dude at 21. Like, where would this guy grow into? He was already pretty damn good at 21. In this environment.
Very quick and very athletic.
They got the heat on Dustin. Dustin drove his face was driven into the mat, and then they just took turns with elbows until Dusty and DiBiase were tagged in. Virgil got in there briefly to choke Dusty, but then immediately tagged DiBiase back in. There's a knee to the back of Dustin by DiBiase on the outside apron, and then Dusty takes DiBiase, runs him into the steps, and Honky Tonk Man gets into the face of Dusty, and this allows Dustin to hit a bulldog, which was his finish at the time, to Virgil. The referee is distracted. DiBiase harbors Dustin Rhodes in the ring and hits a power slam, and Virgil pins Dustin at 9:08. If they really wanted to mess with him, Virgil could have pinned Dusty, but they didn't go that far. It was Dustin taking the fall as Dusty ran in to protect his son at the end of the match.
Yeah, you know, and this was really about as much as we're going to cover from his WWF run, but it was
coming to a close shortly after this time period in early 91.
But you know, I went back and watched a lot of those vignettes of the American Dream with him, like going to playing garbage man or like playing the pizza guy, and boy, were they awful.
But boy, did he give everything he had to them.
He totally did, yes. And he talks about this as much in the, you know, the DVD. And they question whether or not, you know, the whole polka dot thing was a river or not. And then, you know, they kind of close it off by saying that no matter what he was given, he gave it 100% and tried to make it work. And, yeah, that was, you know, certainly... You see a lot of the polka dot signs even last night,
Monday night?
3 nights ago, and especially Monday night. So even if it was a rib, it seemed like something that he learned to embrace, and you know, as a result, I think the audience grew to like.
So, I mean, after this time period, he would return to WCW. He would have his runs as a booker. He always kind of had his finger in the creative pot, whether it was officially or unofficially during that time period. Of course, Dustin Rhodes also would come to WCW. And that drew a lot of criticism when Dusty was booking. And Dustin was certainly getting a push at the time, which I always thought was unfair, because I feel had Dustin Rhodes come into the industry with any other last name and not been attached, I think he would have been a prospect many people would have been high on, but he had the unenviable task of being the son of the booker at the time in WCW. And then Dusty would kind of be segued into just exclusively as a color commentator, which he could certainly be charming, but he could certainly be just lost at times on commentary. I mean, there was certainly a difference that you would see between guys who are great promos and great color commentators, and I think Dusty really illustrated the differences at times. And then later into his career, there was the time period where he joined the NWO, where he briefly left WCW and would have the mini run in ECW before finishing up in World Championship Wrestling. And then during the early 2000s, you'd see him, you know, he started his own independent promotion. He was got back onto the same page with his son Dustin, who there was a 5-year period the two didn't even talk to one another before reconciling in WCW. And then he had a run in TNA that not a whole lot of people have talked about in you know, the news of his passing. But I mean, he was booking the promotion at one point in 2004 and 5 before leaving there. And I always remember when they were still doing the weekly Nashville pay-per-views, that there was one week in 2003 where they announced that Dusty Rhodes and AJ Styles were going to have a ladder match. And I remember, what? Like, this is going to be a disaster. Like, this is going to be just a car wreck. But I have to see how this thing comes off. And I went into this completely expecting garbage. And what I saw, it was like you watch the X Division just do every maneuver imaginable and hit it perfectly. And in this match, Dusty did so little, and he got like the largest reaction on that show. And I always remember that match so clearly. And I tried to search and find it, and I couldn't find it online because I would have liked to have rewatched it. But it certainly opened my mindset to just different forms of professional wrestling and the goal of less but getting the most reaction out of it. And Dusty was such a master of just having that connection with the crowd his entire career, and how he could get away in a ladder match by doing so little, and yet the crowd reacted to everything. And I remember that match so vividly. It was just opening my mind to just different what professional wrestling essentially is at its core. So I did want to make mention of that match. And then, of course, the last decade he had been associated with the WWF, both on the creative staff, where this guy was on the road going to all of the cities before it was 2008 or 9 that they just set him up in Florida with developmental, which go from FCW into NXT, and right up until his death working, handling the promo classes, yeah. Presentation skills, as they call it down there. And
I wish, I mean, I would love to just even, you know, step into the corner of the room during one of those.
They would
classes.
Have been fascinating, yeah. Classes to sit in on.
Like, do they have, you know, handouts? Are there like, is there a chalkboard where he like somehow draws diagrams? I'd love to know all this stuff.
I'm sure it would be fascinating. And he was so important because he was somebody that was, at least I am sure, he looked at certain elements of today's industry and had philosophical differences to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at his promos, and he's got to teach guys ways to deliver your promos in today's environment, which can be very restrictive. You don't have the ability to go cut an 8-minute promo unscripted in an empty arena. You have to do things this certain way. And his task was to get the personality out of a performer in this environment and to be able to work in this restrictive format and still connect with the viewer at home. And I would be fascinated to know his philosophies on how you could achieve that and how the current crop of talent in NXT was able to take those notes, because this guy was so beloved by these people in NXT that just loved working with this guy. Probably the majority who grew up just idolizing this guy and now getting to be one of their teachers, mm-hmm. on a weekly basis. So that kind of wraps up our look at the career of Dusty Rhodes. Was there anything else you kind of had watched or looked at over the past week?
Just a lot of his promos, you know. And I think, you know, freshest on a lot of people's memories was that feud he had with the Shield, along with Goldust and Cody.
Right, right.
That match from Battleground from 2 years ago. And that was probably like the last notable memory I think I have of him really doing anything that, you know, very entertaining on screen.
That was, to me, in the fall of 2013, I thought that was the best program, The Shield and the Rhodes family. Mm-hmm. To me, that was the highlight of Raw for me during that period of time. It was just, it was tremendous. It was great to see Dustin come back at that show in Toronto, and that was just going to be a one-off, and it turned into, you know, getting rehired by the company. It was a legitimately feel-good story, mm-hmm. and Dusty being involved, it was, you know, added so much to that particular feud, and the Battleground match, definitely go out of your way to see that, because that was certainly the highlight of that show, and was just a great, great story that they were able to tell. Do you feel that, in light of this news, do you see them at all abandoning like a Stardust gimmick, or do you feel that this is going to be something that they're going to stay the course with that particular gimmick?
I absolutely think they will abandon it. I don't see how you can make that character work now. I didn't really see them making it work as a babyface anyway, but especially now, Cody's going to get a huge babyface reaction when he gets back. And also, I think the fans want to cheer for him as a real person, not as somebody playing, you know, this really over-the-top character. So I don't really see it lasting.
All right. We are now going to air the interview that Dan Lavransky conducted with Dusty Rhodes. It happened in 2005. This was when Dusty Rhodes was on his book tour. And I believe you can still pick up his book to read more about it. But here he is, Dan Lavransky, chatting with the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes.
Well, since you are at the book signing, I do want to talk about the book off the top. I thought it was a very, very interesting read and very, very interesting perspective on professional wrestling. Did you worry about the tone of the book when you were writing it? Because people that are maybe not familiar with the American Dream might
Right.
think your book came across as arrogant in parts.
I hope it did. I mean, it didn't matter because I think it had meant something to by the end of it, to where they actually seen a different guy, somebody that's not just a wrestler or an entertainer or an athlete or whatever the category that I'm under. They actually seen this different person that came from actually nowhere to pursue that American dream. So that doesn't mean that you're doing what you want to do. If you're good at it, then you're American Dream. So it doesn't. You know, if they took it like that, I mean, I don't really care.
Right.
I mean, because then they didn't really read through it, you know. So,
for sure.
But I'm really pleased with it. I appreciate it.
I was just curious, too, as well as, you know, because since you were, I mean, babyface most of your career, I was surprised with all the swearing. Dusty, you were swearing a blue streak in the book.
I cannot. You know what? I mean, the way I said, I have to write this the way I talk. And I don't say them words, them swearing words. Growing up in Texas, we use them like the dog or the cat. You
right,
know what I mean?
Right.
Because it was an amazing, you know, once I finished with it, and Howard, he said, he's here with me right now, but he said, Jesus, have you really sat back and reread this and listened to this? And I said, well, you know, it's just me, you know, and put a disclaimer on it or something, you know. So, but I didn't mean it to be that way. But yeah, they are. My wife read the first four pages. She said, "I'm scared to turn to the next page because I believe the C word might come up." I said, "No, I don't think so."
I thought like you said, about defining a character outside your pro wrestling character, because the American Dream would never talk like that.
Well, I don't know. It depends on where what he was doing, you know. Like I said, again, the blue collar or white, you know, whatever you are. And I really believe this. And anybody that knows me knows that. Anybody read the book knows that. I believe that there is an American Dream. And it could be anybody. And so if it's anybody, they are people that talk like that. So,
absolutely.
You know, so it's pretty cool.
Now, you talked a lot in the book about Dick Murdoch, and I was hoping maybe I could get one Dick Murdoch story out of you that's not in the book, because fans up here in Canada, we never saw Dick Murdoch as much, right? We really only saw him in his...
No, we were there a little, we didn't get a chance to see him a lot. But, you know, he was just he was wild. I mean, you know, he was Captain Redneck. He was what you, you think, I talk bad. I mean, you know, that, but he was my bud, you know, he was, that, I don't think it's in the book. Yeah, it was in the book, but he just had a way of doing some crazy stuff. He was outside the box all the time, but what a performer he was, you know, so. You know, that's the key to him.
Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate that a lot of people up here never got a chance to see him because, I mean, at least, you know, he was just in tag teams most of the time when he was up here.
Yeah, and he wasn't, you know, sometimes Dickie, the one thing about him, he would be on or he wouldn't be. You know what
yeah.
I mean? He would be in line to be the world's heavyweight champion, and then they would say, oh, no, he's too funny, or he would do something that was really off, you know, off kilter. But he didn't really care. I mean, you know, so, I mean, but to watch him and Wyndham, Barry Wyndham, wrestle an hour in Alexandria, Louisiana to a draw was one of the most unbelievable matches I ever seen. So,
right,
great
right.
timing. He had, you know, he was just tremendous.
He just had to be motivated.
Yeah, I had to be in the right frame of mind and not drink a case of beer the night before, you know.
Right on. Dusty, you also mentioned Bruiser Brody in the book as well.
Right.
I just want to, you didn't talk a lot about him, but you questioned why he was maybe not successful in the U.S., and was part of that because he was just so tough with promoters and would, you know, often do what was right for him and nobody else?
Well, he had that perception, you know what I mean? But, you know, we were... you know, grew up together in the industry, and then before that in Canyon, Texas, at West Texas State, where we first met, we ran around together. I knew him. He was not an arrogant guy. He had a great heart. But he understood that there was a battle that he had to fight. He believed there was a battle that he was fighting between the promoters and the way he wanted to be used. That's why he ended up just being a star in Japan or like in Latin countries or wherever he was, because
right.
he could just go out, punch and kick and kick the, crap out of you and rag your ass and hit you with chairs and throw people through windows. And Japan loved that for him because they had had Abdullah over there and they had had that and they had had Stan Hansen.
Mm-hmm.
But by no means here did he even reach a minute
sure.
bit of that stardom that he reached over there across there. And then, so he had that era that people said, well, he's hard to handle or whatever, but that wasn't true. He was just a man's man. He went out and he did what he wanted to do.
Right.
You know, and I think that's what was important about him, and I loved him, and I think, you know, I wish he'd have had that success here, but he made a lot of money in the Orient.
Were you surprised with what happened in Puerto Rico? Because even if he was tough with the promoters, it seems to be a bit much to die for it.
The story might never be told. I mean, the story that we want to hear the real story, we might not ever know, but I know it was a heartbreaking time for his fans and for people that knew him and what had happened. And, you know, it's just a real shame. You can't comment on something unless I was there or if I knew about it. So I would love to know the story, the real story.
But I'm just talking about when it happened. Were you surprised? Like, were you genuine?
Oh, sure. No, I was. I was surprised. Because he was not like he was in the building. He was not like he was in the arena. He was not like we perceived him to be. I knew Frank Goodish.
Right.
And Virgil Ronald, we ran together in West Texas State. I mean, we bounced together in nightclubs. We worked at the Airspeed gas station. We laughed. I mean, he was nothing like that character that he portrayed.
Right.
And that's all it was. So... You know,
it's just I've talked to a couple guys like Harley Race and Nick mm-hmm. Bockwinkle, and they've said they're not surprised by what happened to Brody in Puerto Rico. They said,
well, that's their opinion. You know what I mean? And mine is that I was,
right.
because I knew him. I
right.
knew him maybe better than they did.
Right. Okay. That's cool. I just wanted to get your input on that.
Yeah, no.
Now, I also want to talk a little bit about when you were in the WWF, and I got this impression, you know, I was a young kid at that time, and, you know, up here in Canada, we hadn't seen a lot of you guys like Harley Race and Dusty Rhodes on a regular mm-hmm. basis, right? And so
right.
when Vince would bring you guys in, it almost seemed to me like he was ridiculing your past successes, you know, making Harley the king in that outrageous gimmick and making you wear the polka dots.
But that didn't matter. I mean, I made that work. There was a year and a half, and the mindset of the wrestling fan and you guys up there is my career. That was not my career with the WWF. My career with the WWF was with Vince Sr.
Right.
Me and Superstar Billy Graham at the Boston Garden. Me and Superstar Billy Graham in Toronto, Madison Square Garden, the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. With DR on his trunks. That was my era there. That ran a long era from 74, 75, 6, 8. 79 when Vince Sr., that was the era. That year and a half was just for, that year and a half I call the internet era. That's when the internet started coming into play to where everybody was a booker and a promoter and a soothsayer, you know. And so they said, well, but you know what? It was a time to where for a year and a half I got my mind clear from what I was doing. I just come off the Crockett thing.
Right.
Just wanted to go make the towns, get paid, and I did. And I turned it into a semi-main event in Toronto at a WrestleMania.
Right.
So, you know, who had the last laugh there? The internet fans or me? I did.
Well,
I put the money in the bank.
Right. No, I understand it. It just seemed,
but
you know.
But there was an era before that. I mean, the biggest era of our industry was in that late 70s and 70s in the Garden and everything. So that was my WWF era.
Right. Now, let's also talk a little bit, too, about after WCW folded.
Mm-hmm.
Now, were you surprised that WCW lasted as long as it did? Because it seemed to me like it was destined to fold even a couple of years before it did.
Yeah, I think that when it was taken over.
Right.
You know, when it came into a corporate thing, when Turner had TBS, and it was just TBS, we did the Saturday morning show, we were on at night. I mean, that was the best. It was the coolest. It was making money. When the corporation bought it, and then it became went to America Online, and went, you know, the whole deal, you could say even 3 years before that deal was headed for a tremendous fall. It mm-hmm. became a tax write-off, and then it just became a cancer that they had to cut out. And that was hard to say, but that's what happened. There was no creativity, ingenuity, or anything put in to making this successful from their behalf. I'm talking about the corporate situation.
Right.
And they would hire corporate guys, or guys that they thought were corporate, to run our industry that knew absolutely nothing about it. They didn't go to film school. So, you know, say you want to do a movie, go to film school or whatever.
Right.
And so that analogy, as I talk about in my book, there were some really dumbasses.
Right. So
that they put in charge, you know. So
do you think that's the main reason that the main thing that killed WCW, letting non-wrestling people run the company? Is that the main thing that killed it?
One of the main. The other thing was the amount of money that they were paying out to guys,
right,
to talent. And I don't begrudge that, because that was one of them. But you just say, here's a tremendous amount of money. And then the guys got smart, and they got their insurance, they got all their stuff done, they had all this money being made, so they get a hangnail to where we were wrestling 360 days a year, you know, twice on Sunday, going all over the country, and it was tougher times. That's just the way it was. It was a tougher time.
Right.
You get a hangnail, I can take off for 6 months, I don't have to wrestle again, and every 2 weeks I'm going to get a check for, let's say, $87,000.
Right.
Well, you know, Jesus Christ. after you pay that out, you say, you know, what are we doing? It's like Giambi right now.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Yankee fan, as we know, and Steinbrenner did the forward to my book, and God bless him for that. But with Giambi, every 2 weeks, he gets a check. They lay it on the table there for $1.5 million.
Wow.
Can you imagine going in your kitchen table and, oh, I've got another check here. What the hell is that?
I know.
I would want to go out and hit, even if I was sick, hit somebody. I mean, I'd want to go out and hit a baseball.
Yeah.
I'd want to go out and say, you know, throw me the ball, man. Let's go. You know, so it was the same with us in our business, you know, and so that was just the era that happened, to where it snowballed. It snowballed into hell is what it did.
Yeah.
And then they became disenchanted with it, and they wanted out of it, and, you know, that was it.
That was it for sure.
TBS was made. Wrestling made TBS.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Turner Broadcasting was made by wrestling in the early 70s, in the 70s, and that's how it started. Not the Braves, not anything else. It was wrestling. And no. Ted Turner will tell you that himself.
Absolutely. So after WCW folded, it's an interesting part of the book. You talk about your return to the working for independent promotions. Now,
mm-hmm.
I want you to compare it, Dusty. What was it like going back to the kind of independent scene compared to what it was like when you started in the 70s working the territories?
In the territorial system in the early 70s, it was an organization of, this was, each territory was big time. Each place was run by a central office, and it was running town 7 days a week. I mean, it was running, you made your living there, and then you moved on to another area, another territory. Independently, most of it, a lot of it, except for guys like Tony Hunter, there are some great independent matchmakers and bookers out there that run their towns correctly. And guys like them are very few and far between, but the majority of them, we went on. It's a plug from a boy at High Spots, who I love, but I can't help it. They do what they do. They can sell you a ring, pair of boots, and almost a book to tell you how to book.
Right.
So now they say, okay, I got to get a promoter's license. Now you're a promoter. You're going to also be a wrestler, so you're going to go in and throw yourself around and say, I'm going to have my family come and watch me tonight. We're going to draw 35 people. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter, but I'm going to be on top, and I'm going to have this belt made by High Spots. I'm going to have my boots made by High Spots. Matter of fact, I can get trunks there at High Spots. I can even order the posters to run the show at High Spots. I would like to be High Spots. I wish I'd have thought of that idea before they did.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So independently, it's become just a shot in the dark. Some work and some don't. Michael O'Brien, who books me off of DustyRoseWrestling.com, my website. Michael O'Brien has been my agent for about 4 years now,
right.
And we make sure we go to the places where we've been, Because I enjoyed doing that. I enjoyed a night in Gaffney. Me and Terry Funk's going to hook it up in Gaffney, raising money for the school in Gaffney, South Carolina.
Right.
But we're going to be there. We're reliving it. I mean, it's fun. I was at book signings today. I don't need to be doing that, but I love doing that. That's what I do. So, you know, and so it's going to be a fun time. So I enjoy going back. But promotion, most of the majority of the promotion is just a hit and miss.
Yeah.
Once a month or once every 2 months. And then a lot of it is just the family orientated.
Right.
I'll buy me a belt. I'll buy me the boots. I'll buy me a book on how to book. And then I can buy a ring too. And with the ring, you can get chairs. God dang, man.
Everything you need.
In public, if you will. So, but the difference was that the organization, it was organized by, you know, each territory was a big time.
Yeah.
That was a big difference.
And there was a governing body over the whole thing.
Huh?
And there was sort of a governing body over the whole thing when it was the NWA.
Yeah, it was. And then you answered to Sam Mushnick. You answered to the NWA, if you remember. To where now I think it would really behoove us to have one governing body or one person over, take about 10 or 11 of the great, of the really good independent things and put them all under an umbrella and you know, take a shot. But TNA, I mean, we got an opportunity at TNA to, you know, this pay-per-view coming up on the 15th, with Jared, our champion, against AJ and Tito Ortiz, combining the USC with us right now, I think is a big move for us, and I think we've got legs with TNA. We just need a better TV time.
Yeah, let's talk. You made the segue for me, Dusty. I was just about to go into TNA, so that's perfect. Let's talk a little bit about that. First off, is there ever going to be a time when someone's going to be able to be competitive with McMahon again? Do you think that will happen?
I think we can. I don't know competitive wise how competitive right now, but I think if we get a time slot on a national television thing, and thank God for Fox Sports Net. Now, I'm not saying that, but 4 o'clock don't get it done for me in the United States as far as drawing a tremendous amount of money and a pay-per-view money and whatever. We need to generate that through better time slot.
Right.
Better times. If we want to go head up, let's go head up because we got a product that's sellable. We got six poles, six sided ring. We got some phenomenal young athletes with some older guys. They're mixed in. Our last pay per view was we took a chance with the eight cages.
Oh boy, did you ever?
You know, the boys brought it home for me. I mean, it was just that simple. Nobody made that thing successful, but them guys that went out there from every match, from the first one all the way through, it was a phenomenal night of entertainment and athleticism. So
this one here is
an opportunity for AJ to take the reins, you know.
Right.
So we'll see what happens with Jeff and Tito, so this one here could actually be the best one yet.
Now, in terms of you know, being competitive with McMahon, do you have at TNA a long-term goal? Like, is there, you know, 3 years, 4 years? Is there any kind of time frame on this?
I'm not at liberty, you know, to talk about the inner workings of the business there. Let me put it like that. But
if
I'm going to do it, if I'm going to create, if I'm going to be head of creative and executive producer of the TV, then I got to have a long range plan, and I do have a long range plan, and I'm sure they do too. But it all hinges on what's going on right now. With all we have to go by is our pay per view. So the pay per view is how much buy rates do we have?
Right.
You can't generate buy rates if you don't have it out there to advertise it. You have to advertise it in the mainstream, and the people have to know, not just the 15,000 internet guys or fans like me and you, which I'm a fan. They're the ones that are keeping this thing afloat. How about the millions of fans out there that don't know it's on, that want a difference? That's who we got to reach, and that's a long-term goal. That's a goal, is to reach them. We're not just wrestling for the internet. We're not just wrestling for Meltzer's Raiders. You know, we're not just doing that. You know, we're not. But thank God for them, because they're keeping it afloat.
Yeah.
Because they understand the industry. I mean, he's taught them the business, and I take my hat off to him. But how about the millions, my moms and dads and people that don't even know what a computer is?
Right.
They're not illiterate, but they don't care about it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the ones that we have to reach, and that's a long-term goal to reach them.
Now, using someone like Tito Ortiz, will that help you reach your wrestling audience when he's more associated with UFC?
I think we'll bring us together currently on television, when people look at us and we're trying to get a better time and we're trying to go to a better deal, saying, hey, they've did something nobody's done. They've interjected this poster boy for the Ultimate Fighting with the poster boy AJ Styles against the NWA champion, and actually make this thing work. And I think that was the whole idea around Tito, is to get mainstream. Jimmy Kimmel the other night, Fox Sports Best Damn Sports Show coming up right next week, a couple other things. So, yeah, that starts to get it out there. So if people aren't listening, we shake them. You grab them by the collar and say, wait a minute, look at this. You know what I mean? So, you know, UFC is important because he's that younger, like I said, that poster boy for that company.
But I don't think Tito's really associated with the UFC that much anymore.
No, I'm talking about Ultimate Fighting. I didn't say UFC.
Okay, all right.
He was the longest reigning champion at UFC for 3 years, though.
Because he's, I think him and him and the company are on the outs now. I think
they're on the outs now, but you know, sometimes you get back on the ins. but Ultimate Fighting is what I mean by that. You know,
okay, well, let's talk, since we're, you know, throwing on booking ideas, let's talk about booking a little bit, because I know it must be, you booked, like you talked about, in the Crockett's, and you booked in WCW, and now you're booking in TNA. Compare the different eras, the differences in booking today and booking, like, say, for Crockett.
There's a lot of difference, and it all goes into the offices of the different places. It's how they market the product. In 4 months, I've taken a product at TNA that was good and made it kind of a little more unique in my own likeness of how I think it should be, created some really cool stuff, made some cool moves happen. But if it's not marketed right, it will not go nowhere. If Crockett wasn't marketed right, it wouldn't go nowhere. WCW wasn't marketed right, it wouldn't go nowhere. So it all boils down to is, hey, here's your product. Here's the product. Now it's up to you to get it out to the public. And I think that's the most important thing, and the differences of all three places of how that product was marketed. And back then we were able to have, as you know, syndication. So we had TV in every market there was, everywhere.
Right.
So syndication, you had your local Saturday night shows, Saturday morning shows, Sunday night shows, Sunday morning shows. You had cable. We blanketed. So, you know, and the proof is in WrestleMania numbers. The proof is in Raw. Proof is in when the NBA does not out, playoffs do not outdraw SmackDown. If you're with whoever's doing the NBA, that just slap you right in the face. Man, you know what I mean? What are we doing here?
Right.
You know what I mean?
What about the actual changes in style? Because, again, you talk about this in your book. I like how you dub the Yellow Finger era. What about the changes in wrestling itself as what it is in the ring, and how to effectively book that with those changes?
Well, you know, during the American Dream era, as we led up into the Yellow Finger era, I looked out one night and I seen all these foam Yellow Fingers being sold, said Hulk Hogan on them. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And I said, there's a change coming, and it's a change just what we've been talking about earlier in marketing, the way you market the product. Smoke, bombs, music, albums, slammies.
Right.
The whole deal. That's the change. The other was, ladies and gentlemen, this corner, the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, and you walked out. You walked out. You wrestled an hour. You wrestled 20 minutes. Told a story. They do that now, but they just took it into a different, they use different film. They use the movie genre. They use different lighting. They use different effects.
Right.
It all boils down to one thing. It's the marketing of the product and the way it was. Yellow Fingers, there was no Dusty Fingers. when Yellow Finger came along, I seen it. I looked at it one night and I said, the change is here. It's coming.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of marketing in 2005, then, what does TNA need to do to usher in new marketing that will make their product more accessible?
Well, you have to let people know what the product is all about. So marketing-wise is, first, television time. Marketing is, I would love to have seen an ad in the USA Today. Full page, half page, Tito Ortiz, AJ Styles, NWA champion, Jeff Jarrett, pay-per-view coming up. To where you have to spend money to make money.
Right.
Okay? And so that's always been my way. If the product is cool and it's okay and nobody knows it's on. So that's gotta be the change. That has to happen. If it doesn't happen, then it's gonna be a shame that this company, TNA, that is right on the verge of doing something so special.
So
doesn't get a chance to run.
Okay, so is it just a matter of resources then, Dusty? Because I mean, it sounds to me like you have a plan, but is it a matter of you just don't have quite enough? You don't have the resources Vince McMahon has.
No, he has the resources over a long. Think about this guy over a long period of time. Think about how long he's been doing this on top with no competition.
Right.
So that it's not that we don't have the resources. It's, we just have to get, we need to get on with it. You know, we need to stop talking about it and do it. If we're going to do it, we need to get off the couch and do it. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think we will. I'm very positive about it. I think it's a, I think we're right on the verge of something very, very special. So I think TNA is going to actually get an opportunity to run the race.
Okay. Now, I found very interesting in your book one of the points of you talked about how you have to be critical of yourself as a booker and that you have to push yourself to the next level to stay in the game. Now, what are the, and I'm sure you've done this with TNA, what are some of the things that you have felt have worked really well in TNA and some of the things that you don't think have worked as well?
Well, I think that a few things that have worked, obviously, is our X Division dominates our, except for our NWA champion. The NWA World Heavyweight Champion is Jeff Jarrett. That's the prize that everybody chases, okay? We know that. The X Division has a unique look. They have some unique characters and athletes that make that special. The six-sided ring makes that special. I do a lot of stuff now, also what we call in the back. You know, my stuff in the back, whether it be with Kevin Nash, talking to Conan, or whatever it is, they're very short, they're to the point, they don't bore you, they don't just run long.
Right.
I wanted to change it up because you only have an hour. I wanted to make the packages that are shown on the guys less instead of more, and the ones that were shown more, better and flow better. And we need to sell time on the show. There's a lot of time that could be sold on that show, and that goes back to marketing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the changes of matchups to where somebody can beat somebody on any given night, I think is the key. To where you believe that. For that 2 hours that you go, I want you to believe that.
No,
you go home and say, you know, that's cool. But if I go to a movie, I don't want to know the end of the movie.
Right.
When I walk in the front door.
So
I want to still have that fan in me to say, God, this is going to be good. You know,
I think you've hit, that's really important part, Dusty. And I think that's a problem even with the WWE product is that you never get the feeling that the challenger can beat the champion.
Right.
It almost looks like everybody's a jobber half the time.
Yeah, and if you go and know that, why go?
Right.
Why watch? I mean, sure, the glamour, the glitz, the tits and the ass and all that stuff. That's cool. But I want to go, like I said in the movie, I don't want to know the outcome. I don't want to think I know the outcome. I want you to show me the outcome. I want to live it. Then when
right.
I drive home, I'll say, I knew that. You know, I told you I knew that, Howard.
Because,
you know what I mean? But
I'll say something.
I think we've taken that away from the fan, and I think that needs to come back, and I think that's what we're trying to do at TNA.
You're absolutely right. And even you know, the greatest internet fan that wants to know all the inside scoops and wants to know what's going on, he still wants to be fooled when it comes to match time.
Exactly. They want to say, well, we're really sure that this is going to happen, and we're right about it. And, you know, hey, they got the blah, blah, blah. Well, and then when you get fooled, that's when you say, man, this was cool stuff. So it makes the real fan even more anxious for it. And I got a bunch of people lined up here for this book signing. I'm going to have to get out of here.
Okay, just one more quick
one
thing.
More.
One more about retirement. You make the joke in the book that you're not going to retire until Terry Funk does. Do you honestly see yourself going that long? Because I don't think Terry Funk will ever retire.
No, it's me and him tonight. Like I said, in Gaffney,
yeah.
I don't think he will. I'm doing a lot of motivational speaking, a lot of bookings out, a lot of stuff with the book. We're working on a screenplay right now, also a pilot for television with my team that I've put together. So we're looking outside of the box, and my whole time is really full with TNA. And trying to make stuff happen, and I'm looking for it.
One other really quick one, Dusty. The WWF, did they ask you to be in the Hall of Fame this year?
Well, Superstar Billy Graham came out, and we had talked about it a little bit, but not only in a roundabout way. There was talk about it the last 2 years, but I turned it down. I would turn it down because of conflict of interest, but it didn't seem to bother any of the rest of us. You know, they're having an ECW pay-per-view, and they're using some of our guys,
right?
Which was okay. I mean, I want our guys to make money, and they were a part of ECW and whatever. But, you know, so I just looked at it a little different. I'm a little more loyal to it, and I would love to, and Vince says, you know, he has my utmost respect. I mean, it's just we recreated each other against each other, and we'll continue to do that until... You never say never, you know what I mean?
All right, and we're back, and we're going to finish up the show going to the the feedback thread at lawradio.proboards.com, which is where you can go each and every week to leave your feedback, chat with other listeners, and check out all of our archives, which feature, I'm certain, many, many Dusty Rhodes matches throughout our archive of review away shows. And we'll start things off with Clean Finish. Dusty Rhodes versus Ric Flair and Tully Blanchard matches were always classics. Long live the NWA WCW World Six-Man Tag Team Championships.
We go to Christian Small, who says, the first time I heard about the Dream was probably his run in ECW with Steve Corino, and while many may look down on that, it personally made me a fan of Dusty and Corino. I felt they worked so well together. I probably won't be alone when I say that Dusty's run with Flair over the NWA title and his Hard Times promo are some of my favorites from his career. I was also a big fan of his team with Sting, especially their work with the Horsemen and the Road Warriors.
All right, we go to Randy in Australia. I don't accept the notion that it's impossible to get the magic of a wrestler years after the magic passed. When I became a wrestling fan in the mid-90s, seeing some old tapes with Dusty matches is what made me the wrestling historian I am today. Dusty is the reason for the four huge boxes of wrestling tapes in my garage. He wasn't the best worker. He wasn't the best promo. He didn't sell the best. In fact, I think it's probably fair to say that if he were 50 years younger and auditioning for Tough Enough last week, there's no way in the world that he would have been chosen. But for me, Dusty Rhodes is without a doubt the most amazingly charismatic wrestler of all time. There were some great matches, obviously the Flair and Harley Race matches, as well as some of the early tag matches with Murdoch, but I think the real appeal of Dusty was in those promos. The magic was in the way that he spoke to his people, that working man's rap. How could you not love him? And if you were a kid growing up in the South in the 70s and 80s, how could you not have thrown your money at this guy? He'll be dearly missed. He and Flair are the two reasons that I'm a wrestling fan today, and I felt like I lost a bit of my childhood when I heard the news.
We go to Chris in Ottawa. Hey, guys, I like a lot of youngsters in Canada and the northern U.S., I first learned of Dusty when he began to appear on WWF television, and like so many, I loved him from the start. They always speak of how Dusty could talk people into the building better than anyone ever has, and I believe it. I wanted all the crap he hawked in the WWF merchandise catalog, as this video demonstrates, and you can see a link there. It's fascinating now to revisit his WWF run, understanding now that it was a way for him to recharge his performing batteries and not hold the pencil while in New York, and the son of a bitch really did manage to get polka dots over. I don't know if it was a rib, a challenge, Vince McMahon's wild ideas run amok, or some combination of all of that, but they dressed him up in the black with yellow polka dots, and as a kid, I never cared. He was that good.
Brad from Whitby, my first exposure to Dusty was when we started getting Nitro in Canada, and most people would say that his commentary was not always the greatest or even understandable. But even if he was making no sense, you could see that he oozed charisma. Now, I'll be the first to admit, I have never been a huge mark for Dusty, but my one live experience was something I'll remember for a long time. A buddy and I made the trip to Buffalo back in October 2013 to see Battleground. I believe this was one of John's least favorite shows that year, but it had Cody Rhodes and Goldust taking on The Shield with their jobs on the line, and Dusty was accompanying his boys to the ring. There was something about Dusty at ringside threatening to take his belt off and give The Shield a lashing that made the atmosphere in the building electric. When Goldust and Cody won, it was the only huge pop of the show, and I believe the celebration after was made that much more special with having Dusty there to join with his boys. Dusty had been around the sport for a long time, and he most definitely had some interesting stories to tell, but for me, I always enjoy hearing other wrestlers tell their own Dusty stories. It just shows you how loved and respected he really was, and everyone he touched, and the one unique Dusty story that they are always willing to share.
Tom from London. I'll keep it short and sweet. One of the all-time great promos, and a man with the sort of charisma that comes along so rarely, a true one-of-a-kind who is another sad departure from the industry, only too familiar with such sad losses. Just dining with kings and queens from now on for the American Dream. Rest in peace.
And finally, we go to Lee Russell. You've got to respect the American Dream, not just the promos, not just the work in the ring, but he was also a major force in creative and talent development. I've read and heard that he had a bit of an ego behind the scenes, but what top guys haven't really? Few and far between. I also read and heard that he treated the top guys and the underneath guys the same, maybe in part because he wasn't exactly anyone's idea of a pro wrestler when he tried to get into the business, but he was given a chance and he ran with it. He was the sort of guy who wasn't supposed to make it in the business and he did it anyway. Rhodes was just as important in getting the Four Horsemen over as the Horsemen themselves were, and you have to respect a guy like Rhodes surviving in the WWE office for 10 years, as there he was in a he was a bit of an outspoken original. There will never be anyone like him again, which is quite sad. And that will wrap up our show dedicated to Dusty Rhodes. A fun look back at a very storied career way.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Very educational for me.
Yeah, I think that that's, you know, it's a silver lining when someone so important passes away. It gives you kind of that push to go back and learn even more about him. So it's been fascinating to see so many people writing about him and just an ability to go back and, you know, with things like the network and, you know, so many of these, you know, having all these tape libraries under one umbrella, it does allow you at least a concentrated project like a DVD that can give you a pretty good retrospective of a guy's career and then seek out whatever holes are left in something like that. So fun to go back and watch so much of this stuff over the past week, but we delayed it by a week.
Yeah.
Next week, we will take a look at our original plan for the review this week.
Yes, the new WWE release, Daniel Bryan.
Yes.
Just say.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Actually, we're going to be reviewing the Berserker DVD, Huss, Huss, Huss.
Just say Huss, Huss, Huss.
Yes, the John Nord story.
We will be reviewing the new Daniel Bryan release. And we didn't really realize, at least I didn't realize when we first chose this, but really it's largely the same documentary that is currently available on the network of his journey to WrestleMania 30. So if you guys just want to watch that and leave some feedback, just go ahead and do that. Journey to WrestleMania 30, Daniel Bryan. This is the same documentary that is featured on this new release of the DVD, along with a few extra minutes. And we'll tell you all about, you'll get our thoughts about the DVD, which we had never really talked about before. But along with that, we'll tell you like what bonus features there are on it. In particular, there's a lot of extra interviews that they've done with him talking about more current events, a lot of things after WrestleMania 30, and a lot of the behind the scenes. So we'll talk a lot about that, especially some of the matches, bonus matches that are featured on the DVD.
Yeah, including a tryout match he had in 2000, mm-hmm. which is pretty incredible given his level of experience at that time. And you'll also see a young Brian Kendrick in that particular match. So be fun to go back and watch some of those matches because people are not familiar. Daniel Bryan is on his third stint with the company. He had a mm-hmm. developmental deal way back in the 2000s. And then, of course, he came in for NXT and the Nexus angle. He was fired during that very famously. And so it's run number three for Daniel Bryan that he's on. So an interesting career, to say the least, that we'll chat about next week. I want to thank everyone for your feedback that you sent in this week. And for checking out the Dusty Rhodes interview, we're also going to upload that on its own on the Live Audio Wrestling website. So we will be back. We've got lots of shows planned this week. We'll have a Bauer and Pollock show. We're going to get Quartz Thoughts, a man who worked very closely with Dusty Rhodes during his time in the WWE and even worked with Dusty when Quart was promoting MLW shows and used Dusty. So we'll chat about that with Quart. We've got new episode of What's Next coming out Thursday. Friday, we'll have Review and Impact with Brian Mann and Nate Milton, the MMA Report, and The Law. Sunday night, we will have Alberto El Patron on the program at 11 p.m. Eastern time. So we are going to end things off with one final Dusty Rhodes promo, and we'll chat with you next week on Review Away.
Yeah, Vinny, you know, this is a good chance. You know, it's always a little yelling, a little screaming, a little really get down fever and boogie when I'm rapping and never get a chance to sit down and rap with my people and talk to you. When I was a kid growing up, I did have a dream. You know, I look around this building, I look around at the things that go on in this building, the people screaming and hollering, and it's a quiet time for me. It's a personal time for me because my dream is every little child's dream or every person's dream that ever wanted to be anything. It is an American dream. There is an American dream. Hell, whether it's filling a building like this or if it's doing plumbing like my daddy did, as well as you can do it, you understand? I mean, just as good as you can. I just thank God that there are people like yourself come out to see the American dream, because when I was growing up, I sure didn't think 265 pounds of blue-eyed soul would captivate a country like I have. The people drive me. There's never been a man, I don't think, in sports anywhere gets a natural high. That might be it. You look around at a natural high from doing what he's doing. It's not dope. It's not pot. It's not whiskey and wine. I drink a little whiskey and wine. But it's every man, woman, or child that really believe in the American dream. And this building, you know, Vinny, this building, I'm getting down now because I'm seeing things in my heart. This building will be full, it's true. There'll be screaming and hollering and jumping and shucking and jiving. Because this man knows no color barrier. He has no qualms about going out and eating dinner with a black man or Puerto Rican or a Greek man or a Chinese man or Mexican-American or anybody like that. Because I was raised to understand a man is a man first. When he proves himself a man, no matter what color he is, no matter what creed he is. Playing football, you know, back in West Texas, we had many black guys on the team. Really boogie get down fever boys. And there were a few people around the town there in Texas that were still down a little bit on blacks. And now the world's changed. The arenas have changed. You can look up in this building in a matter of a few hours when it's full, and you can see a black man and a white man eating out the same popcorn box. Woo! That's funky. That's the American dream. And I don't care too much for politicians, you understand, or don't get involved with what's their business. All I know is my business is making you happy. And I get a little sentimental when I'm thinking about it, because making you happy makes my dream fulfilled. And God knows I love you. Now, whether it's superstar Billy Graham or Bob Backlund, the great, great champion that he is, or whether it's sitting here with Vince, or whether it's Freddie Blassie, or Captain Lou Albano, or The Weasel, or any of his people, or Spiro Therion, there is a triumph in an empty building. When I can sit here and really let my feelings go, telling you in 2 hours, there will be full of screaming people for one thing. For one instant in their life, everything else don't matter but the American dream. Now, whether I carry that banner like I should, sometimes it takes help from you. But I tell you one damn thing, I'm going to carry it forever and ever. The American dream lives in this empty building.
Dusty Rhodes.